Well, today in our Big Questions of Life series, we're going to be talking about culture. And culture can be just very soul-inspiring, and it can be a real downer. For example, if you live in North Korea, the culture is pretty oppressive. But if you live in a lot of places around us, culture is pretty great. And so what should the Christian attitude be toward culture? And this should be true of all cultures everywhere. Christians everywhere should be able to have these same thoughts no matter what their culture is like, right? So one culture that was a little negative was in John Bunyan's day. I love the book Pilgrim's Progress. I read it periodically, and I think it's very clever, and it catches my imagination, you know. So that was written by John Bunyan in the 1660s. It was written by him when he was in jail, and he was in jail because he was preaching in an Anglican, you know, he's in England, in an Anglican environment. And to preach, you have to have a license from the government because there was the state church. And so the state church has to give you an ordination certificate and a license to preach. And he didn't have that. And he was a very popular preacher. Sometimes he would preach and draw crowds. One occasion that we know about from history, he was preaching at 7:30 in the morning in a barn and the surrounding area, and there were 1,200 people that came to him on a weekday. And so all the Anglican pastors are saying, hey, he's not even licensed, and he's attracting all this attention. So there's a little bit of jealousy, and one thing led to another, and they arrested him for preaching without a license. He was in jail for 12 years for that. They said, if you promise you'll never preach again, we'll let you out. And he couldn't make that promise, and so he stayed there. One of his daughters was blind, and she kind of counted on him for security. But he was in prison in this jail, the Bedford jail, for 12 years, which basically means he missed her childhood. So it's quite a thing to imagine. And he wrote Pilgrim's Progress in that environment. And he said in his book that there was this place called Vanity Fair, and here's how it goes in Pilgrim's Progress. And at the town, there is a fair kept all the year long called Vanity Fair. And this fair, at this fair, are sold all such merchandise as houses, lands, powers, kingdoms, women, slaves, pleasures, and delights of all sorts. Silk, ivory, apes, peacocks, and the souls of men. And at this fair, there is at all times games, plays, jesters, and rogues of every kind. Now, as I said, the way to the celestial city lies just through this town where Faithful was arrested with Christian for causing an angry stir. You'll notice those things I put in green, they sound kind of good, right? Like, yeah, I'd like to buy houses and lands, and silk is good. I don't know what I would do with it, but okay. Ivory, apes, now that could be interesting. Peacocks, maybe. And then there are games and plays. Well, everybody likes a good drama, so games and plays and clowns, you know, it sounds okay. But look what else is there. There's also the souls of men. They're selling the souls of men. That means kidnapping and slavery. And on a, you know, spiritual level, that means they're ruining people's lives on the inside out. And so this is all Vanity Fair. It's all our culture, a little bit like our internet, right? Our internet has some great stuff on it, and it has some really awful stuff on it. And that's how Vanity Fair is. Well, as the story goes, Faithful was arrested there because he said some things that were considered hate speech. And so in court, the lawyer says, prosecuting Faithful, "My lord and you gentlemen all, this fellow I have known for a long time and have heard him speak things that ought not to be spoken. For he has criticized our noble prince Beelzebub and has spoken contemptuously of carnal delight, vainglory, and greed." And in the jury, the jurors were talking. My favorite is Mr. Blind Man. He's blind, and he says, "I clearly see." So he's blind. "I clearly see that this man is hateful." Another man says, "I could never stand him." Another man on the jury says, "Nor I, for he would always be condemning my way." And another man says, "Let us dispatch him out of the way." And then Mr. Implacable, he can't be pleased no matter what you do. He will not be at peace with you. Mr. Implacable, he says, "Might I have all the world given me, I could not get along with him." So that's how it went with Faithful in court. That's what our culture is like. I have two suggestions for you as we look at the scriptures pertaining to our attitude toward culture. The first suggestion is we must not allow our minds to divide our way of life into two categories, sacred and secular. And I'll explain that in just a minute. But the temptation is that we're willing to divide everything up into two categories, sacred and secular. And that's a very bad idea. I'll show you in just a moment. And then the next really important suggestion is to realize that you should brace for this truth, that Christianity will always be countercultural. That's just the way it has to be. So let's start with this first idea. We must not allow our minds to divide our way of life into two separate categories, one called sacred and one called secular. Francis Schaeffer, who's a good Christian thinker, he says, true spirituality covers all of reality. In this sense, there's nothing concerning reality that is not spiritual. And what he's saying here is that you have to integrate Jesus into every part of your life. Do you know that if you kiss your wife, you are doing a Christian thing because God told you to love your wife and you're expressing love? So you can't say, well, that wasn't really my Christian duty, because, of course, it was very Christian of you to do that. And you need to integrate Jesus into every moment of your life as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus. You should always be integrating what Jesus wants you to do with every portion of your life, even if you go to a movie, even if you're listening to music, no matter what you do. Don't divide it up between sacred and secular. Put Jesus in every part of your life and integrate him into each moment of your day. Colossians 1:23 is so good this way. This text says, and whatever you do. So, you know, are you playing a sport? Are you doing a hobby? Are you going to work? Are you eating? Are you sleeping? Whatever you do, it doesn't make any difference. Whatever you do, do it heartily, you know, from your soul. Give it some thought. Be a sincere person and do a good job of it. So whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men. Whatever you do. And just like that, 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, whether therefore you eat or drink, all these mundane things, right? It doesn't matter. Whether therefore you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all for the glory of God. Whatever it is that you're doing, you're going to do it all for the pleasure and reputation of God. Titus 1:15 says, unto the pure all things are pure, but unto the defiled and unbelieving is nothing pure, but even their mind and conscience is defiled. So you know what that is, right? One person looks at the internet and says, this is so helpful, I'm going to get a tutorial here. It's going to show me how to fix my laundry machine. So that's so helpful. That's one way to think of the internet, right? Another guy looks at the internet and says, I am going to scam people and try to get into their bank accounts. Well, it's the same internet. But unto the pure, all things are pure. But unto the defiled and unbelieving, now even something like the internet becomes a weapon and a destruction. And so we have a choice. There's a good way to look at a child, and there's a way to look at a child that's not good. There's a good way to look at an elderly person, and there's a way that's not good. There's a good way to look at almost everything in life, and there's a way that's not good. Be pure, and a lot of things that other people say, well, that wasn't so good. If you are pure in heart, a lot of times it's okay for you. We'll talk more about that as we go. But whatever you do, do it heartily and do it for the glory of God, and do that with your art, music, and entertainment. It's really important that we quit using these terms like, oh, that's Christian music, and oh, that's secular music. You might be able to find music that is very Christ-centered, that is very overtly talking about Christ. But hopefully you realize that you shouldn't divide these categories up. Same with books. Oh, that's a Christian book and that's a secular book. Maybe you shouldn't call that book a secular book. Maybe if a Christian is reading it through Christian eyes, it brings a challenge to him that is very wholesome, very Christian. You shouldn't say, well, this is what I do for fun, and that's what I do for Christ. So what are you saying then? What you do for fun is displeasing to Christ? I mean, have you thought this through? Maybe what you do for fun should also bring glory to God, right? Maybe what you do for fun should also be done heartily as unto the Lord. So, for example, if I am listening to Willie Nelson sing the song From Here to the Moon and Back, and this is sort of like one of the songs that Teresa and I love, And so we come to that place, and I'm humming quietly or singing along with the song, and it says, I want you to know that you can depend on promises made and love without end. No need to worry how faithful I'll be now and on into eternity. So I am putting my arm around my wife, and I'm saying, there is no need for you to worry how faithful I'll be for now and forever. Is that a Christian thought or is that a secular thought? Is that then a Christian song or a secular song? Because it sure is having a Christian impact on me. So you see, Jesus is supposed to be integrated into the music we listen to. He's integrated into our lives in such a way that you can never say, oh, well, that's what I do for the Lord, but this is not for the Lord. Every book I read is supposed to be integrating Jesus into my thought grid. And so if I am reading, as I mentioned in Sunday school in 1995, if I'm reading How to Win Friends and Influence People, you say, well, that's a secular book. Are you sure? Because it has impacted me in a Proverbs Christian kind of way. Are you sure that's a secular book? Maybe Jesus is supposed to be integrated into the so-called secular parts of our lives. And in that case, it's no longer secular, is it? You see, if we're integrating Jesus, if we're making him Lord of our song life and Lord of our book life and Lord of our fun life, then in what way is he not Lord? And in what way is that not Christian? In what way is it still secular? You see where we are here. We should be fascinated with art. I mean, isn't that great? What if we're talking about the look of a Harley Davidson front fender? That's a really good job. And did you ever notice like Corvettes? Don't you think that a 1964 to 1967 Corvette is beautiful? I mean, those guys. Yeah, see? Those guys were smart. Like, wow, that's a really good job. All right, so you see, we should be fascinated with art. And, excuse me, also if you like, you know, Mozart and Rembrandt, that's a good too. We should be fascinated with art intellectually and emotionally. From music and movies to fashion and architecture, isn't it great? Now that I'm old, you know what happens when I go to Busch Gardens in Disney? I always look at the architecture and the gardens and think, wow, you know, that's very cool. I think I'd like to do that in my backyard. I haven't been able to pull that off, though. But we should also, and this is important, we should also politely keep a safe distance from art that tends to inspire untrue or unloving thoughts in me or in others. So when I look at that art, that is inspiring thoughts in me that I don't like very much. And I hope other people don't have those thoughts either. Then we have to separate ourselves. It's Vanity Fair, right? If you want to, you can get silk and ivory and there are plays. But it also sells the souls of men. Like, oh, I see how culture works then. Don't say when it comes to your work, don't say, well, that's Christian work. That's a Christian job, a Christian career. And that's a secular job or a secular career. Don't say, this is my work for the Lord. Now I'm going to serve the Lord on Sunday morning from 11 o'clock until noon. I'm going to serve the Lord. And then we ask, well, who are you serving the rest of the time? You don't want to say, this is my secular work. Because truly the pastor is not serving the Lord full time more than the plumber. And as a matter of fact, Colossians 3:23, when you talk about whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men. That is in the context of work. As a matter of fact, it's in the context of employer-employee relationships, or even more specifically, household servants, housekeepers. And so it's telling the housekeepers, do a good job keeping your house. Sweeping, repair work, office tasks, whatever it is that you're doing, you want to do these things as if the Lord is watching you. You do it according to His standards and you do it for His approval. He said, but I'm just sweeping a floor. Yes, but sweep the floor really well, as if you're trying to do it for the Lord. Because whatever you do, right, whatever it is, do that for the Lord. When it comes to science, don't say, well, this is Christian science and that's secular science. Or this is religion and it's for the heart, but science, that's different. It's for the mind, for the intellect. Don't make that distinction. True advancement and true science is very Christian. All of those advancements will always be very Christian. So, for example, if we're talking about medical breakthroughs, isn't that great? We discovered a medicine that works, or we discovered a treatment that's really helping people. Isn't that great? Isn't that a Christian thing? So if I'm a Christian working in a pharmaceutical lab and I discover something that's really helpful for polio or whatever we're talking about, isn't that great? Isn't that what a Christian would want to do? Isn't that a very Christian thing? In what sense is that a secular job? And we do that with all kinds of jobs. What if we're just talking about exploring the wonders of creation? I'm a botanist, and we're making a new kind of tangerine, or we're doing something with crops to make them more productive and healthful. Isn't that a very Christian thing to do? That's awesome. You're doing God's work, same as I am, or anybody who's in so-called, you know, Christian work. We've talked about agriculture and technology. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to put a device in the brain of a person who has Parkinson's, and then he won't have tremors so much. Or we're going to develop a communication platform so that a guy on his Navy ship can call home with video and talk to his family. Like, is that not a Christian thing? That's awesome. You're doing God's good work. You're spreading love and communication, and you're relieving suffering. Don't say, I'm in secular work. You're serving the Lord. We should be fascinated with science. Science is great. We should be fascinated with it intellectually and emotionally. And we should always remember that truth, wherever we find it, is God's truth. If it's truth in a laboratory, that's just as good as truth in the seminary. All truth is God's truth, wherever we find it. But it's Vanity Fair, right? Besides the cool things, they're selling the souls of men. You have to be careful. So we should politely distance ourselves from anti-science claims that are just dressed up to look like science. And there's a difference. So, for example, ironically, an atheist who prides himself on being loyal to science proposes that, just randomly, everything that you see around you came from absolutely nothing. Absolutely everything from absolutely nothing. That is philosophical nonsense. You cannot derive absolutely everything from absolutely nothing. And if somebody says, well, the science establishment tells me that that's the way it is, that's nonsense. And that is not science. So out of nothing is what we call magical thinking. You cannot get everything from nothing. That's magic. That's not science. And so imagine the cosmic explorer who stumbles upon the universe creating machine, right? There are rows of dials and knobs and gauges, and they control everything about the universe. And if they were bumped even a little bit to the left or right, the world would not be able to sustain life. Many rows of dials, each one important. That's the way our universe is. We call this the fine-tuning of the universe. Imagine if the dials were just a little bit off. The strength of nuclear force. What happens if the electrons don't stick around near the nucleus of an atom? What if they go spinning off? What if they come crashing into the nucleus? It can't happen. It's got to be just right. The dial, the gauge has to be just right. Gravitational constant, the Planck constant, the ratio of the neutron mass to the proton mass, the strength of electromagnetic attraction, the correct fraction of oxygen in our air so that we can breathe and be healthy, the correct distance from the sun to provide the right temperature, the correct ozone layer for UV protection and a moderate climate. The proximity of our planet to a large planet like Jupiter to deflect away the meteors and asteroids. If any of it was wrong, then we can't be here. It's very carefully put into place. And this is why Sir Fred Hoyle, recently deceased astronomer of some fame at Cambridge, he says, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics, as well as with chemistry and biology. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. And a recent Wall Street Journal article by Eric Metaxas said, it would be like tossing a coin and having it come up heads 10 quintillion times in a row. Really? Who's going to believe that? Well, that's not the only problem with science. We can talk about spontaneous generation in evolutionary thinking. It's called abiogenesis, which means life rising from non-life. And of course, that also is spontaneous generation. In Wikipedia, just, you know, general knowledge, common knowledge, nobody disagrees with this. Rejection of spontaneous generation is no longer controversial among biologists. Like, nobody questions. All of our textbooks say you cannot derive life from non-life. That's never going to happen. So in the old days, remember the theory by the Belgian chemist was, if you take a soiled shirt and a few grains of wheat, the chemistry from the shirt and the wheat will blend together, and in a few days you'll have mice. And that was the science of his day, the 1500s. We laugh at that now. That's silly. You cannot get mice from a dirty shirt and a few grains of wheat. That is never going to happen. And yet we live today in a world where we are often told that all life rose from what started as a Big Bang, out of nothing, and then became primordial soup with no life in it, but then life came. So Nobel Prize-winning physiologist George Wald says, we scientists are choosing to believe the impossible. Do you see how important that phrase is? You cannot wrap yourself in a cloak of science and say we have chosen to believe the impossible. That's magical thinking. We choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance. See, that's not science. And if the science establishment says you have to follow the science, and then they ask you to believe in magical thinking, you're not obligated to do that. That's not what a reasonable, logical, scientific mind would require. And so we should be fascinated with science because all truth is God's truth. Science is great. Science is awesome. But we should politely distance ourselves from anti-science claims that are just disguised to look like science. Money and possessions. Don't say, well, this is the Lord's money because I'm going to put it in the offering for the church. I'm going to donate it to charity. So this is the Lord's money. And then the rest of it is my bill paying and entertainment money. You're supposed to integrate Jesus into your life such that whatever you do heartily as for the Lord. Like, I think the Lord wants me to use this amount of money to pay my electric bill. I think the Lord wants me to go on vacation. I think he does. I think he wants me to enjoy a little time off. And so now you have integrated Jesus into every part of your life, and don't say, well, that's my sacred, my Christian time, and this is my secular time. As Christians, we never have secular time if we're following Jesus. Don't say this church, you know, where we're worshiping, this is what we call the Lord's house. But that place where I eat and sleep, that's my house. No, don't say that. This house is certainly the Lord's house because it's for him, right? But your house is the Lord's house too. I mean, he has allowed you to have this nice place just for a little while, right? Because you're going to die someday and somebody else will live in that house. So this is really the Lord's house. You don't get to keep this. You're not the owner of it. You're the steward of it. You're like an administrative assistant, and you have charge over this property for a little while, but not for very long. And then you don't have charge over it anymore. It's the Lord's. And you get to use it whatever you have, all of your possessions, for the Lord's purposes, whether it's, you know, this building that we're sitting in right now or the one that you'll go to when we dismiss. And don't say this is the church's sacred money, like, oh, I would love to give money to the missions outreach, but I don't want to pay the light bill. Like, no, it's all the Lord's money and it all has to be done. So don't say this is more sacred than that. It's all under the Lordship of Jesus, right? We're going to do that with all of our money and possessions. But remember, we should carefully avoid any thought that money can buy lasting love and awe, because that would be untruth. That's not true. Now remember this too. Christianity will always have to be countercultural. I wish it weren't so, but that's the way it is in Vanity Fair. There are some things that we're pretty excited about, and there are some things that are pretty awful. And so culture is our Vanity Fair. Christianity will have to be countercultural because the combined constellation of cultural norms, you know, not just one cultural norm, but the combined constellation of cultural norms are what the New Testament denounces as the world. Last week, we surveyed 34 Bible passages on the world. So I don't want to belabor that. I'm going to go through half of those again in just a minute, just half, and much more quickly. But what the Bible calls the world is what we call culture, and it's kind of scary. So we will have to be counterculture. Some individual cultural norms are great, right? Great. What could be better than some of the wonderful breakthroughs in science and technology and art? I mean, such nice things, wonderful. But the overall spirit of human culture revolves around things like greed, selfishness, ego, exploitation, and hollow pleasures. That is the world in the New Testament. And in any time of real crisis, the trouble is the world gets pretty brutal. So we Christians aren't going to be brutal. We're going to have to be counterculture. All right, so here we go. Really, really fast. Like last week, but half as many and much faster. The world is evil right now. John 7:7. The world cannot hate you. Jesus was talking to his enemies who hated him. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that the works of it are evil. In John 12, now is the judgment of this world and the prince of this world. That was a description of Satan and his evil spirits. He's the prince of them. The prince of this world will be cast out. John 14, I cannot talk much longer with you because the prince of this world has come. In John 17:9, Jesus says, I'm not even praying for the total culture. Isn't that amazing? I do not pray for the world. In Romans 12:2, do not be conformed to the world. There's a lot that's happening in this culture that you can't let ruin your life. Galatians 1:4, Christ gave himself for our sins that he might deliver us from this present evil world. The world is evil right now. Ephesians 2:2 talks about the direction of this world, the course of this world, which is not good. It's following Satan and his plan. In 2 Timothy 4:10, Demas left the Christian faith. And why did he leave it? Because he loved this present world. And it's too bad. In James 1:27, pure religion and undefiled before God is this, to visit the orphans and the widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world. Like, you're in Vanity Fair and there are a lot of things that might really mess you up. So you have to be so careful. In James 4:4, do you not know that friendship of the world is enmity, animosity toward God? Whoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. If you're going to just accept everything in Vanity Fair, that's going to be a real problem. 1 John 2:15, do not love the world. If any man loves the world, the love of God is not in him. Everything that's in the world has been corrupted. In 1 John 5:19, the whole world lies in wickedness. There's a problem with Vanity Fair. There's some great things, but there's a problem with Vanity Fair, a really big problem. In 1 Corinthians 11:32, we realize that this evil isn't just for now. It's going to continue. It's not going to get better and better. It's going to continue being evil until Jesus comes. 1 Corinthians 11:32, we are chastened with the Lord sometimes so that we should not be condemned with the world. Vanity Fair is going to have to be disassembled. 2 Timothy 3:1, in the last days, perilous times shall come. Evil men and seducers shall grow worse and worse. So it doesn't get better and better. It gets worse and worse until Jesus comes. And all of these texts talk about the target of some of this evil is going to be us as Christians. We are going to be the target. So Matthew 10:16, Jesus tells his disciples, I'm sending you out to Vanity Fair like sheep in the midst of wolves. They'll deliver you up. You're going to go to court. There's going to be problems with governors and kings, important people. And then you'll be hated of all men and they'll persecute you until the Son of Man comes. So it doesn't get better and better. It gets worse. Matthew 24:9, the same thing. They will deliver you up to be afflicted. You'll be hated of all nations. There'll be great tribulation. And then finally, the Son of Man comes. There's going to be trouble in this world and trouble towards us. In John 15:8, if the world hates you, you know it hated me before it hated you, Jesus says. I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. In John 17:4, the world has hated them. You know, Jesus praying for his followers. Father, the world has hated them. They say things against Vanity Fair that Vanity Fair doesn't like. American culture, at our very best, at our most Christian-friendly time, we still had huge swaths of our population that were plagued by these things. Racism, first and foremost, toward black people. But not only that, people hated Italians, they hated Irish people. There were lots of problems as people fought over racism. Greed. Just imagine that the typical idea that you have in your mind of a used car salesman or a dishonest politician. Greed. Family breakdown. At our very best, there were far too many families doing things that were quite cruel to their parents, to their spouses, to their children. At our very best, American culture at its very best had big problems with ego, cattiness and bragging and stepping on other people to get status and applause and selfishness, trampling over the wishes of some really nice people who didn't deserve to be trampled. At our best, we always had these problems in our culture, intoxication, becoming impaired and unruly after drinking. At our best, there's always been a huge population of America that has had problems with these things. But now it's even worse. In addition to all of that, we have added something that is new and a little different to American culture. We sometimes have it under the heading of wokeness. And this is part of Vanity Fair that's going to be a real problem for us. The most defining feature of every person's personality, they say now, is the color of his skin. You know all about a person, whether he's an oppressor or oppressed, by the color of his skin. But the biblical faith is all about the inner man. We're not supposed to be making conclusions about the outside, and yet that's what Vanity Fair is asking us to do. After skin tone, another key and defining feature of every person's personality is their erotic interests. But in the Christian faith, erotic interests are always channeled toward heteronormal marriage. And the Christian faith also talks about finding true happiness without erotic interests. And for the foreseeable future, at least, it looks like the trend is that dark-skinned people and non-heteronormal people should be given preferential treatment. But see, the Bible has a problem with preferential treatment, no matter who it is directed for and towards. And so that's a problem. Jews and Gentiles used to fight in the church, and then came along the New Testament says, from now on, there's no more Jew, there's no more Gentile. It doesn't matter what your nationality is. It just doesn't matter. And so it's weird to have Vanity Fair making us go back to that. Public hostility and legal punitive measures must be employed to force privileged people to concede privilege to the underrepresented. But again, this is weird. The outrage and the revenge and the violence that's being perpetrated, that's Vanity Fair. That's not where we are. Majorities that respectfully disagree with woke principles should be menaced until it is no longer worth it to them to oppose wokeness in any meaningful way. But the Bible forbids us to be discourteous or violent toward any person or even unkind. And then institutions, corporations, or churches that do not concede to the complaints and accusations of protected groups must face legal punitive measures and the loss of reputation and profit. That's a problem for us as churches. We have always treasured free speech and that sort of thing, because when free speech goes away, we're the first ones that get hammered. So, since the Christian faith, as it is said, since the Christian faith had a disproportionate influence on Western civilization, now churches should be constantly criticized and disenfranchised. And now churches should be threatened with legal punitive measures for things like hate speech and what we're going to do for weddings, various weddings, and employment, who we're going to hire and who we're not going to hire, and how we're going to work out restrooms and all those things. And we're in the crosshairs now. And that's the way Vanity Fair sometimes treats us. Cultural trends are a little scary along these lines. Generation Z, you know, the youngest ones, born between 1996 and 2010. When we survey them, 60% believe that systemic racism is widespread in society, and 64% believe that rioting and looting is justified to some degree in order to address this. So rioting and looting, but Christians can't do that. 51% believe that two-gender view of humanity is outdated, but that's where we are. 40% according to Barna, or 16% according to Gallup, self-identify now as LGBTQ, and that's not going to work for us. 41% believe in censorship of hate speech. We've got to shut it down, and we are the ones, they say, that are producing hate speech. And 23% support violence to silence speakers who are using hate speech. So once again, violence. But the New Testament forbids this. Cultural trends among adults. Those are the very, very young adults. Here are the normal adults. 53% of college students right now, which is barely a majority, right, are in favor of freedom of speech. One University of Hawaii law school professor said, formal criminal prosecution is an appropriate response to hate speech. An MSNBC host, well known, says we have to break through our private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize kids belong to the whole communities. So it's not up to the parents. 60% of Americans favor same-sex marriages. Christian schools shall be prohibited from establishing anti-LGBTQ policies. This was a bill that was filed in the state of Florida but not passed, but it gives you an idea of where things are going. Right now, we Christians are indeed being increasingly resented, hated. And that comes in the form of shunning and even sometimes legal threats. Because we're advocating for creation in the marketplace of ideas. Because we're arguing for the unparalleled historical good of the Christian faith and pioneering human rights around the world. A moment ago, I mentioned the idea of in Jesus Christ, there is neither Greek nor Jew. There are no Jews and Gentiles. That was groundbreaking when that was written by the apostles in the first century. There was nothing like that in the Roman Empire. There had never been anything like that in human history. That was groundbreaking. And now we say, of course, we don't care if you're Jewish or Italian or from one of the Asian countries. We just don't care. But that was groundbreaking. And that has become now the whole basis of human rights. That's from Christianity. And we argue for that, and that's not appreciated. We're advocating for truly equal treatment for people of all skin colors. We're advocating for heteronormative lifestyles. We're advocating for courteous and nonviolent debate in the marketplace of ideas. This is where we are, and that's not working right now in our culture everywhere. On Sunday, October 13, 2019, Pastor Keith Simon from Columbia, Missouri, preached a message. It was a kind, thoughtful message, biblically teaching that God only recognizes two genders, male and female. On Monday after the Sunday, a social media firestorm broke out, and more than 1,000 people signed a petition saying that everybody should disenfranchise this church. They were no longer welcome in the community. That's the way things are in Vanity Fair. Well, there's good news then, right? The good news is we can enjoy, truly enjoy art and music and books and movies and sports and architecture and inventions and technologies and delightful foods and holidays and decor and travel and hobbies and all these things. And we're given permission to enjoy them in 1 Timothy 6:17. Command those who are rich in this world, and most of us are pretty rich in this whole, you know, global thing, that they be not high-minded, you know, don't be big shots, but trust in the living God. And this living God is so nice that he gives us richly all these things to enjoy. That's the good news. That's so great. The bad news is Christianity will always be countercultural because many aspects of culture inspire untrue and unkind thoughts in us and others. And we're reminded, James said, that friendship with the world is animosity toward God. And if you choose to be all in on Vanity Fair, then you're going to be an enemy of God. So that's what we're left with. Culture. Enjoy what inspires truth and love. And then just keep a safe distance. Politely keep a safe distance from anything that inspires in you or in others untruth and unlove. And that's the Christian attitude toward culture.